All right. Thank you. I'm Kyle Nations. I'm a recovered alcoholic. And God's grace, I haven't had a drink since April 5th of 2015. So good to see you, Jack. April 5th of 2015. It was Easter Sunday. I'll never forget it. And in fact, when I introduce myself, and in some meetings they give your sobriety date, I usually give that date, the day of my last drink, because that's the day I don't want to forget. And I really don't want to forget it. Chris, thank you for inviting me to speak. I hadn't been here in a long time. I hadn't been to this place in a long time, and I was really encouraged by how many people there are here and how much energy there is in the room, like really good energy. You guys are really pumped up. It talks in the big book. It says we're not a glum lot, right? We're not a glum lot, and we absolutely insist on enjoying life, and clearly you guys are enjoying life because you could just hear it, in the beginning of the meeting. I have no idea what I'm going to say, so I'll just start. I'll tell you, qualify a little bit, and then what I really want to talk about is recovery through the 12 steps, which is what saved my life. And my story, probably like your story, is a little unique. There's little bits of my story that are unique, but I want to make it clear I'm not unique. And I tried to be unique. I wanted to be the exception, you know. I wanted to be different. And I fought this thing for a long time. I wish I was the guy that came in on my first meeting and stayed sober, and I'm not that guy. I was in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, in and out of treatment centers for 20 years. Now, for you guys that are in treatment, if this is your first time in treatment, this can be your last time in treatment. And if it's your 10th time, that's fine. This can be your last time. The pain and misery can stop here, right? Anybody willing to do this work and to be honest and open-minded qualifies and is capable of getting sober. That's been my experience. I have yet to meet anybody that couldn't get sober. I was the guy who would have said, you know, there's that part that we read in How It Works. There's people that might be constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. I thought I might be that guy, but I found out I'm not. You know, I was just unwilling. So I'll just tell you briefly a little bit about myself. I grew up in sort of a middle-class family in Arizona. My father, however, had a drinking problem, a bad drinking problem. And I swore I would never be like him, and wouldn't you know, I grew up to be a lot like him. And the main thing that I grew up with around him was when he wasn't drinking, he was what they describe in the big book as restless, irritable, and discontent. I could definitely identify with that. I had this discontented feeling my entire life. In fact, what I would say is I had sort of chronic dissatisfaction, just chronic dissatisfaction. I could not find any sort of happiness in life. And as a result of that, I was sort of a depressed kid. I was painfully shy. I isolated a lot. And this is all before I picked up a drink, right? So a lot of the behaviors were there, you know, real self-centered, like to go off on my own. I was a guy that drank by myself, but before I even picked up a drink, I just liked to go off and be on my own. I didn't like to be around a lot of people. I didn't feel comfortable with people, right? So, like a lot of us, I picked up a drink at a fairly early age. Some of you might not have had this experience, and if you didn't, that's fine, but a lot of us have this experience. It was a magical event, the first drink. It was a shot of relief that I did not know was possible. And I had, you know, what I would call almost a spiritual awakening. I mean, the minute that drink went down, you know, my next thought was, I got to figure out how I can do this for the rest of my life, you know. And that's what I did. I pursued it for the rest of my life. So that was the beginning, and I started to have consequences almost immediately. right? I started to have consequences almost immediately. I got kicked out of school, suspended from school, allowed to graduate in high school. I went on to college. My drinking really progressed there. At the time, this is a long time ago, but the drinking age in Arizona was 18, and I think I had a fake ID when I was 16. So I was drinking I was buying liquor and drinking at a young age. I was smoking a lot of marijuana. And there's a lot of drugs in my story. I tend to talk more about the alcohol because alcohol was the first thing I used and the last thing I used. But I shot heroin, I smoked crack, I snorted. I mean, I did all of it, right? I sometimes think I ought to, you know, qualify myself as just a trash can because I would take whatever you had to change the way I feel. So anyway, you know, let me just read something out of the doctor's opinion, which really, really speaks to exactly what my drinking was like. It says, men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. And if you're a drug addict and you're here, insert drugs, you know. We like the effect produced by a chemical. The sensation is so elusive that while they cannot admit it, they can admit it is injurious, they cannot after a time differentiate the true from the false. Couldn't differentiate the truth from the false. The truth was I was having consequences as a result of my drinking, but I couldn't see it. I vaguely sensed that what was going on in my life that was not going well had something to do with my drinking, but I couldn't make a connection to it, and everybody else seemed to be able to see it. And people started, at a fairly early age, people were saying, you know, man, you, Kyle, you drink too much, you know. I would drink before I went out. I would drink way after it was time, you know, closing time. I would always make sure I had some for the next day. I was always making sure I stockpiled enough of whatever it was so that I wouldn't run out, right? And so I drank because I liked the effect produced. I didn't drink because my parents weren't nice to me. I didn't drink because of all these sort of personality effects that I talked to you about. I drank because I liked the effect produced. And, you know, alcohol and drugs, too, were, for me, it was a love affair. It was a relationship that I had with those things. And unfortunately, it turned on me. At some point, it turned on me. And these consequences built up, and pretty soon, you know, I ended up in treatment is what happened. I ended up in treatment at my first treatment center. So I've been to a lot of treatment centers. I used to hate to say that. I had so much shame and guilt around having gone to treatment so many times. I felt like I was a slow learner or something. And I guess I was. Slow learner and a fast forgetter, right? So I would go to treatment. And really what I was doing was I was not going to treatment to change. I was going to treatment to get the heat off, right? I was going to get a job back, or I was going to get a relationship back. I really wasn't going for the reasons of trying to get sober. I just wanted the consequences to go away. That's what I really wanted. I wanted the pain to stop. And so I went to my first treatment center, and this is in the mid-90s, and they sent me to AA. And you know, I went, but I didn't really listen to everything they said. They said, get a sponsor. I was like, I don't really want to get a sponsor. I don't think that's important. You know, I thought that if I just learned enough about alcoholism and addiction, that maybe that knowledge would somehow allow me to figure out how to drink successfully. And so that's what I thought I was getting in treatment, but that wasn't. I wasn't doing it for that reason. I was just doing it to get the heat off, over and over again. You know, I just could not seem to surrender. And they talk about that in our steps about the importance of surrender. Right? It's so important to surrender. And what does that look like? Well, you know. So, you know, turning yourself into treatment is a good first step. And I used to think, you know, well, okay, so I've surrendered. I've gone into treatment. And now I would think that that's, I'm recovered, but I'm not. I haven't done anything else. Surrendering is really, you'll know if I've surrendered by the effort that I'm putting in after I leave treatment, right? So let me describe to you also what I kind of view as what the real alcoholic is, which is what I am. It says, what about the real alcoholic? He may start off as a moderate drinker, and I think, you know, I don't think I ever started off as a moderate drinker. I think I was an alcoholic from the very first sip. He may or not become a continuous hard drinker, but at some stage of his drinking career, he begins to lose all control of his liquor consumption once he starts. He is the fellow who has been puzzling you, especially in his lack of control. He does absurd, incredibly tragic things when drinking. He is a real Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. He is seldomly mildly intoxicated. He is always more or less insanely drunk. His disposition while drinking resembles his normal nature, but little. He may be one of the finest fellows in the world, yet let him drink for a day, and he becomes frequently, disgustingly, and even dangerously antisocial. He has a positive genius for getting tight at exactly the wrong moment. And that really resonated with me because, you know, we're coming up on the holidays, and holidays were a time when I just would literally implode. I would destroy the family, you know, the family functions. I would end up actually going to treatment or disappearing during the holidays. You know, a lot of feelings would come up. I wouldn't want to deal with it. And so I would escape into the bottle or into crack cocaine or some other substance, and I would just disappear, right? And I would get tight at exactly the wrong moment. I did that too with work. Like I would have, you know, I was able at times to sort of pull it together. Like I would describe myself as more of a binge drinker or a binge user. Like I could actually put some time together and not drink and use. And I promise you, and for especially for you guys in treatment, if you just don't drink alcohol and don't use drugs, your life will improve. And so I would have this improvement for a while, and I'd be able to show up at work, and I'd be able to sort of carry on normally, you know, on the outside. But there was nothing, the inside was not normal. The inside was not being treated. I was not doing anything to treat my condition. And so I would carry on normally for a while, and then I like a ticking time bomb. At some point, I would be like, "I got to drink, I got to use, I got to," and I would twist off, and then boom, I'm gone. You know, and people would say that about me. They were like, "Man, you're really a pretty good guy when you're not drinking, but man, you're a mess when you drink and use." You know, absolute mess, and I was. So that describes me, the real alcoholic. So I would have these, like I said, I would have these periods of, I'll call it dry. Let's call it dry because it's really not sober. Because sober is about working a program. Sober is about taking action. Sober is about showing up, right? Being of service, being of help, doing the steps, you know? And that's not what I was doing. I was just sort of being dry. So I would have these periods of time where I would sober up or dry up. And then the insane thought would come, right? The insane thought would come. And the insane thought was always something like this. I would forget how bad it was, or I would think, this time it's going to be different, right? And it talks about it. It says, the almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, They are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we'll handle ourselves differently. There's a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. So I had this amazing ability to just forget about how bad it was. Like I would come into treatment, right? And I would be begging, you know, I would have been drinking maybe for a month, and I would be begging to get in somewhere, you know, please, you know, looking for funding and all that stuff. So I finally get into treatment, and I would be there like one or two days, and I get some sleep finally, and I get a couple hot meals, and then I'd think, man, I overreacted. I don't need to be here, right? I mean that's how we think. You know, that's the obsession of the mind. That's my mind telling me that despite all this evidence I have that suggests it would be a really bad idea to leave treatment, or it'd be a really bad idea to pick up a drink or a drug, I'll ignore that, right? I'll ignore that. So my problem really does center in the mind. It centers in the mind. I've got a mind that tells me, despite all the evidence that suggests I cannot drink, it tells me it's okay to go ahead and drink. So I forget how bad it was. I think this time it'll be different. It talks later. It says, sometimes we feel justified by anger, nervousness, jealousy, bitterness. You know, so I'd have these feelings. And behind these feelings, I would say, yeah, maybe I should drink, you know, to relieve it. But that's insane, because a guy like me who's drinking over some anger or any kind of unrest, it's only going to get a lot worse. So I've got this obsession, right? I've got this obsession of the mind, and that's where it starts. But then the other part kicks in, right? So I stop drinking. For some reason, I'm able to stop drinking somehow. I'm able to stop using drugs. And then I put it in my body, right? And then we know what happens from there. I have an allergy to alcohol and drugs. And I'm sure they tell you that in treatment. I'm sure you heard it. When I first heard that word allergy, I was like, well, you know, I don't really break out in hives. I don't really start sneezing. I don't really have that kind of reaction. I can't really understand this allergy. And then somebody explained it to me, simply that an allergy is an abnormal reaction. I don't react the same way that other people do when I put it in my body. So I've got these two things working against each other. And that's really bad news. There's not good news at the end of that first step. It's bad news. I've got a mind that tells me I can continue to drink and use despite all the evidence that suggests it's a bad idea. And I've got a body that condemns me to continue to drink and use once I put it in. So I can't quit and I can't stop starting. And that's fundamentally what my problem is. So something had to intervene. Something's got to intervene on these thoughts, right? Something's got to intervene on these thoughts. And I very rarely have them, but occasionally I'll have one. Like I was driving down 35 or somewhere, and I saw a billboard for something called White Claw. And I was like, man, I've never had White Claw. What's a White Claw? What does a White Claw do? Right? That's what does it do, right? So, but now it's like, oh, that's an insane thought. You know, it just sort of flies by. Like I can see it for what it is. But until I did this work, there was nothing to intervene on that thought. It would just go right in and boom, I'm taking action on it and I'm out and I'm on another run. So something had to intervene. And so what is that? What's this thing that's got to intervene? So, well, I told you I'd been to a lot of treatment. I'd read these steps, right? I'd been to meetings. I'd heard them read. I really didn't want to do them. I tried them, and I started to get some results, right? And I started to, they talk about the goal of these 12 steps is to have a spiritual awakening, okay? And I think that can come in iterations, right? Because some of us, and I'll put myself in this category, and I know there's other people in here, may have had a spiritual awakening and thought, well, that's it. Now I've had it, and now I don't need to do anything else, right? I did that. And it didn't work out very well when I stopped doing all the things that I did to get the spiritual awakening in the first place. It's not sort of a one and done. It's something I've got to continue to sustain. So I had some glimpses of this, and I started to have some realizations that maybe there was a power greater than me. And I'll talk, you know, let me talk about that real quickly, because I think it's important to be clear for anybody that struggles with the idea of spirituality or God. You know, it says this in our big book. It says, "We found that God does not make too hard a terms with those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. It's open, we believe, to all. When therefore we speak to you of God, we speak to you of your own conception. This applies to other spiritual expressions you may find in this book. Do not let any prejudice you may have against spiritual terms deter you from asking what they honestly mean to you." So if you hear somebody talking about God and it doesn't line up with your understanding of God, that's fine. Develop your own understanding. And in their wisdom, really genius, it was genius to say God as you understand him. It's God. It's a personal God, you know. And I grew up with some religion, and I had a lot of biases about that. And so I had to get over that. I had to put that aside. I wouldn't call them spiritual experiences. I would call them minor spiritual awakenings. I started to maybe think this thing would work. But the problem was I would never follow through, right? I would never follow through. And so I would go to treatment. I would go to meetings for a while. I would sober up. And then I would stop doing the things that I did in the beginning. And my inner condition would deteriorate. My selfishness and self-centeredness would start to would come to the surface. You know, it talks in our big book about how we're like the actor who wants to run the whole show, right? We're the actor that wants to run the whole show. And the problem is nobody would do as like I thought they ought to do, right? I was an actor trying to be the director is what it was. And nobody's acting the way I want them to. And I'm getting restless, irritable, and discontent. And pretty soon, to drink sounds like a good idea. And so I had periods of, like I said, I would sober up or dry up. And I had a period of 2 years once. I had a period of 3 years once. I even had a period, I was 2 weeks short of 4 years once. You know, I'm about 4.5 years sober now. But it looks a lot different now because I continue to do the things I did in the beginning. In fact, I probably do them more today than ever. And I don't do them alone. And what's so encouraging about being in a room with this many of you is it gives me assurance, because I promise you, I could not do this on my own. And if you're out there thinking, if you have what I have and you're out there thinking you can do it alone, good luck. We don't do this alone, you know. You know, if you're in treatment now, or you've gotten out of treatment, or you're about to get out of treatment, you're an alumni. Do not get disconnected from people. Do not isolate. Get numbers. Force yourself to call, connect, and be with other people that are in recovery. It's key. It's key. We cannot do this alone. I want to talk about the third step real quick, because the third step was one that was sort of confusing to me for a lot of years. And for those of you that you know can read the third step and know it, you know, it says, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him, right? So that was really confusing to me for a long time. And one of the reasons why it was so confusing to me was because I was really trying to figure out, well, first of all, I don't really know God. And secondly, I really don't know what God's will is for me. How am I supposed to know what God's will for me? How do I know what my will is, and how do I know what God's will is? And it's really laid out brilliantly again in the big book, and it talks about what the third step decision is, right? And the third step, to me, the most important decision comes in the first step. And some people say, well, you don't really make a decision until you get to the third step. And I would say that's not true. And I'll talk about that in a second. I think you're making the decision all along the way, right? The third step says the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. As long as I was convinced that I could run my life successfully, as long as I was convinced that I could continue that I could just go to meetings once in a while and introduce myself as an alcoholic, but not do any other work. As long as I was doing that, I was still running my life. I was compartmentalizing my recovery, right? You know, recovery was something I did like going to work or, you know, being a parent or, you know, being a son or a husband, right? It was just one part of my life. But I was not convinced that my life run on self-will can't be a success. I still thought I could run it. And then it goes on to talk about all this, you know, it talks about the thing that, it says selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problem. And when I heard that, I was like, well, I mean, alcohol and drugs are my problem. And I'm going to propose to you that are in this room, if you have what I have and you're not drinking and using right now, alcohol and drugs are not your problem. They are when you're drinking and using them. But at some point, if you're like me, you'll come to treatment. You'll go to prison, been there too. You'll go to jail. Something will intervene and stop, and you'll stop, but you'll start again if you don't do anything else, right? So my problem, I found out, is really not drugs and alcohol. It's these manifestations of self that show up in my attitude, my desire, my want of running the whole show, my expectations I put on people, my dashed expectations when they don't act the way I want them to, and I get disappointed, and it gives me a good reason to get high and get drunk again. So that's what's wrong with me, right? So that's what had to be treated. So this it says the first requirement is I be convinced my life run on self-will can't be a success. And then it says this is the how and why of it. We had to quit playing God. I had to quit playing God, right? In fact, when I finally made this decision, my sponsor had told me this before, but it really resonated. He said, Kyle, it's not really important who God is. What's important is you know you're not God, right? That's what's important. You know, I mean, as I'm sitting here tonight talking to you, I feel like over the last four and a half years, whatever it's been, I feel like in some ways I understand God less today than I ever have. And I'm really cool with that, actually. Because I can't tell you a lot specifically about God, but pull up a chair after the meeting and I'll tell you all the stuff that God has done in my life. Amazing stuff, right? I mean, I'm a guy who was homeless, lived on cardboard boxes. I could not keep a crack pipe out of my mouth. I went to maximum security penitentiary. I mean, that's who I am when I'm drinking and using, and I'm not treating my untreated alcoholism and drug addiction. But I'm not that guy today. I'm a different guy. Something happened because I finally became willing to throw myself at this thing 110%. That's the only reason. I'm not special, you know. I'm no different than anybody in here, but I got enough willingness and enough honesty and enough open-mindedness to actually do something about it. So I made that decision, right? I made that decision. And I talked about that a second ago, about this idea of decision. And I talk a lot about this. I always like to bring this up. Is this idea of choosing and deciding, right? Choosing and deciding. The book talks a lot about the fact that we have lost the power of choice when it comes to drink. Right, and that always sort of struck me kind of strange, because I would think, well, here's all these people when I go to AA meetings, and they're obviously choosing not to drink, right? And somebody straightened me out one time. They said, "No, I don't. I'll tell you in my own words. I didn't wake up this morning and choose not to drink. I didn't choose not to drink. I don't choose not to drink, but I made a decision" to do some things. There's a big difference between those words, choose and decide, right? Choose is sort of like, well, I might do this or I might do that, right? But decide is a more final word. It's got that Latin root in it, side, which means to kill off. Like pesticide, homicide, suicide, it means to kill off. So when I decide to do something, I'm killing off the alternative. I kill off the alternative. So my first step decision was, am I powerless over drugs and alcohol or not? Second step, am I willing to believe in a power greater than myself or not? And now, am I going to try to run my life or am I going to try to do it some other way? Do it the way you're telling me to do it. And so that's what that third step decision was. And then how do I know if I made that decision? I go on to the fourth step, right? That's how I know. I go, I'm all in. So I did a fourth step, and I got to look at all of these manifestations of self. I got to look at my behavior. I got to look at how I show up in life, and I got to look, and for you guys who have been in treatment or been in 12-step programs, you know what the fourth step's about, right? It's about resentments. It's about fears. It's of sex inventory, and it's the harms that we've caused. You know, and when I went into that, I'm like, well, I'm pretty resentful at myself. I've certainly done a lot of damage to myself and other people, and I resent myself for that. But I don't see that I'm that resentful against other people. And my sponsor said, just take the pen and write it down. And so I did. And I didn't think I had a lot of resentments. I ended up with a lot of resentments, right? And then when I got to the fears part, he said, write down your fears. I'm like, I really don't think I'm afraid of anything, you know? I mean, I'm afraid of going back to the penitentiary, you know? That doesn't sound good to me. But other than that, I'm really not afraid of anything. He says, okay. He says, you afraid of not having any money? Yeah, I guess I am afraid of that. I've been without money and I've been homeless and it's not too fun. I am afraid of that. How do you do when you do have money? Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's nothing worse for an alcoholic and a drug addict, worse than bad fortune than good fortune, I think, you know? Like, I can handle a bucket of crap. It's a pot of gold that I struggle with, right? So I would get a lot of, I mean, all I was doing when I was accumulating all this money was getting ready for my next run, basically. That's what I was doing. I was loading up. I was stockpiling. So I was afraid of not having money. I was afraid of having money. How about you afraid of being alone? Yeah, I'm afraid of being alone. You're right. How about you afraid of people? Yeah, look at all you, man. Yeah, I'm afraid of people too. How about you afraid you're not going to be able to find a job? I just gotten out of TDC. I had a record and all this stuff, and I didn't my prospects for my resume did not look very good. It had a lot of big gaps in it. And I said, man, yeah, I'm afraid I'm not going to be able to have a job. He said, how do you do when you have a job? Yeah, I'm pretty scared too. So I started. You get the idea. Basically, I was afraid of everything. I was afraid of everything. You know, and then I got to look at my behavior towards others and the harms I caused, and especially in intimate relationships. You know, I mean, talk about a resentment. I had been married a couple of times. I had a major resentment against the institution of marriage, for example. Right? I didn't do too well in that area, but I had caused some real wreckage and I had caused some harms. And so I wrote all that stuff down, and then I shared it with him, you know. And then I was, and if you don't have a sponsor or you don't have somebody in your life to help you see this stuff and look at it, get somebody like that. Get somebody who will be honest with you and tell you the truths about yourself, right? Who will help you see the truths about yourself. Critical. And then I got to the eighth step. You know, and I had this list of people that I had harmed, and it was a big list. And I haven't made them all, right? About a year ago, I guess it was, I went back to Arizona, and I hadn't seen my father in like 12 years. He lives in a nursing home. And you know, and this is another reason why it's really good to have a sponsor, because I was going to go to my father and tell him all the stuff I had ever done, right? Which, by the way, he knew, right? I was going to tell him how, you know, the times I stole from him, the times I came home drunk, you know, the times he had to pick me up at the jail. I mean, and so I was basically going to go, I was wrong when I, and then list 50 things. And my sponsor said, you know, what's the one thing your father really, really would really make your father happy? I said, I think he just doesn't want to worry about me anymore. He said, well, tell him that. And I did, you know, and I get emotional thinking about it, but you should have seen the look on his face when I said that. I said, man, you don't have to worry about me anymore. You know, I've got a different way of life now. It was like it was like 40 years of pain just fell off him, you know. It was a miracle. Now, that's a really good story about an amend. I've got a younger son who is going to be 18 in March. I have not talked to him in 5 years. He doesn't want to see me, right? But I'm willing to make the amend. I can't make the restitution. And by the way, our big book doesn't promise reconciliation either. It promises us an opportunity to clean up our side of the street, and that's it. And I make the attempt, and I write him every couple of months, or every month, I guess it is. And he still doesn't want to talk to me. I've got a younger sister who lives in Arizona, and she's a psychologist and a social worker, and she doesn't want to see me. But I'm willing, and I make the attempts, and I still make the attempts, right? And I'll tell you one of the most miraculous amend story. And I don't have a lot more time, but I'll tell you this one. It's a good one. So. I didn't really tell you the event that got me here. Let me tell you about the event that actually finally sobered me up. So I was sober about 3 years, and I told you my life would get good, and I stopped, you know, I'd not drink and use, and I got a good job, and I got a sports car, and I got a pretty girlfriend, and I got all this stuff going on in my life, and I'm like, look how good I'm doing, right? And then I'd stop doing this kind of thing, or I'd stop doing this stuff. And that's what I did. And one day I picked up a drink very casually, you know, that I decided I could start drinking wine. So I start drinking wine. And 6 months later, I had 3 felonies, right? And let me tell you about the felonies. So I had over the years already amassed about 6 or 7 DWIs in various states. And the computers hadn't all connected and talked to each other. So with that many DWIs, I had never had a felony DWI yet, right? So I was drinking, I was living in a hotel room, I was going through what little money I had left, and I got a DWI. And then they found the other DWIs. They have a way of finding stuff. I was facing a felony charge. And I bonded. I had enough money to bond out, and I bonded out. And I told my lawyer, I said, I got to go to the doctor and get something to taper off. So I got a prescription for Xanax. Okay, yeah, you know what's coming, right? So I didn't stop drinking, and I kept taking the Xanax. And I went into a 2-week blackout, and I got 2 more DWIs. And on the third one, I was going to pick up all my furniture in a U-Haul, driving down I-35 in a U-Haul to go pick up my stuff at my girlfriend, my now ex-girlfriend, who just kicked me out and had all my furniture and stuff. She said, come get your shit, you know. And so I got a U-Haul, and I'm driving down I-35, and I clipped an embankment, and 5 cars plowed into the back of me. And some of those, and fortunately nobody was hurt really bad, but some people got hurt. And they went to the hospital, and I went to TDC. right? And I'm lucky that I did about a year. And I decided, that's when I really decided that I was going to change. But when I got out, so while I was in TDC, I'm writing my sponsor and I'm writing to people in AA. And I said, man, whatever it takes, right? And I became willing. And so one of the things that I realized when I got to my amends was I needed to make amends to those people that I hurt. And so I asked my sponsor, I said, you know, how do I make amends to these people? He said, go ahead and write your insurance company and write your lawyer and ask them how to get in touch with these people. And I got the same letter from both my lawyer and the insurance company, which said, you don't talk to those people at all, because there was some civil litigation and some other stuff, right? So I didn't talk to them. And then I got out, and I kept doing the work, stayed in recovery. And about a year ago, and I'm on social media and stuff, and I'm on a lot of social media recovery groups, by the way. But I post openly about my sobriety and about my life. And about a year ago, I got this message on Facebook Messenger, and this woman says, Kyle, she says, I want you to know my mother and my daughter were in the car directly behind you, and they were hurt. Please don't stop reading this. Continue to read. She says, I want you to know that I check on you once in a while. I see how you're doing. I see how your life is improving. I see that you're living differently. I know that alcoholism and drug addiction is a disease. And we want you to know that we forgive you and that we want you to do well. So, I didn't have to do anything, right? I didn't have to do anything except what you guys told me to do. And then my life changed, right? And it became evident to other people. And I was able actually to get a hold of the daughter, actually not the daughter because she's too young, but the mother, and I was able to in an email make amends there too. So that's the kind of stuff that happens, right? And I'll just close with what I do to stay sober today. So, you know, that time I told you about, right, what precipitated these three DWIs and all this stuff, I had a sponsor, Tim Powers, right? I had a sponsor. And Tim one day called me, and I hadn't talked to Tim. And he's still my sponsor, by the way. I hadn't talked to him about, I don't know, probably a month or two. And one day I get a call from him, and he's like, hey, Kyle. I'm like, hey, Tim. He's like, how you doing? What do you think I told him? Fine. I'm fine. Everything's fine. And he said, well, I hope you're talking to somebody because you're not talking to me. And I wasn't. And it wasn't long after that that I picked up the drink. So I don't let that happen anymore. I'm accountable to a lot of people. I've got a lot of people in my life that know I'm in recovery. People at work know I'm in recovery. You know, my girl's here, and I told her, if I ever come home with alcohol on my breath, lock the door and hide. And I mean it. And see, and that's not the kind of thing I would have said before. I would have given myself a little avenue, right? But I don't give myself any avenues to get out of this thing. I'm all in. I pray and meditate. I belong to a group called Two Way Prayer. I think they might have done some of that here at some point, or they may do it, where, you know, basically I you know, they always encouraged me to journal, and I never did. But I've started doing that, and then I sort of listen for God's voice, you know, however it manifests, and I get some really powerful stuff. And if they do that here, or if you've ever heard of it, when you get out, or if you are out, you can go to twowayprayer.org. It's all AA based, and it tells you how to practice this. And then I do this. You know, and I come here and I try to carry the message and be of service. And in small ways, this is like the biggest way that I could be of service, right? To stand in front of you guys and try to be authentic. But it's the little stuff, too. It's like showing up at a meeting 30 minutes early. My home group is the Rule 62 group at Breaker and Parkfield in North Austin. And if you get there, please get there 30 minutes early, and you will be greeted by about 20 people at the door. You're gonna get a greeting if you come to my home group, whether you want one or not. And that's what we do. You know, I do that. You know, I set up the meeting. If there's somebody that's new at the meeting, I introduce myself and I shake their hand because that's what I was told to do. Right? If I don't recognize somebody at a meeting, I go in and introduce myself. And if we had enough time after the meeting, I'd introduce myself to all you guys too, because that's what I was taught to do. So that's it. This way of life is amazing, and I almost missed it. I almost missed it, and I almost missed it because I just didn't decide that I would be all in. So if you're here tonight and you're wondering, you know, what to do, just do the next right thing, the next thing in front of you that commits you to do something that's going to give you a spiritual awakening that's going to be sufficient to overcome alcoholism. Because if you've got what I've got, it's not a good thing. But if you do have what I have and you do that, the world's your oyster. So thank you so much for you guys being here.